Please join me in welcoming Sarah Hunter, Chief Economist and Assistant Governor Economic at the Reserve Bank of Australia to the stage.
Thank you, Adam, for that lovely introduction. It's an absolute pleasure to be here today. I would just like to start by also acknowledging the traditional owners and custodians of the land on which we're gathered. We're very lucky in Australia to have a First Nations people who take such good care of our land, country and culture and pass that on to future generations. So I'd like to pay my respects to elders past and present and extend that respect to any First Nations people here with us today. So today I want to talk about the labour market. It's a market that almost all Australians will have some first-hand experience with over the course of their lives. I dare say pretty much all of us are in this room today because we are on the supply side of this market, though I do know we have a couple of university students in the room who are future suppliers into the labour market. And many of you who are business professionals will also have substantial experience on the demand side as well in the staff that you employ. For macroeconomists like me, understanding the labour market is particularly important as it sits at the heart of the economy, given that every single good and service we consume requires some form of human input at some point to produce it. Conditions in the labour market are closely linked to conditions across the broader economy. Indeed, the labour market is so important it forms part of the RBA's monetary policy objectives, or our mandate. Under the Statement of the Conduct of Monetary Policy, the Bank's Monetary Policy Board sets policy over time achieve sustainable full employment, which is defined as the maximum level of employment that is consistent with low and stable inflation. This means that our full employment objective is closely linked with our inflation objectives. So while deviations can occur and do occur in the short run, over time, if the labour market is in balance, that is, it's achieving full employment, then inflation will be at our mandated target, that is, it will be low and stable. So a bit like a double helix, the twisted ladder shape that encodes our DNA, full employment and price stability are separate yet entwined. Now, given this relationship, understanding current and future conditions in the labour market and how they are reflected in underlying inflationary pressures defines the core of the Monetary Policy Board's decisions. So today, I want to expand on how we think about full employment, how it reflects our inflation objective, and how we assess whether the labour market is in balance before I briefly comment on the outlook from here. Now, so to cut to the punchline, our current assessment is that while there has been some easing in the labour market since the pandemic, it remains somewhat tight. Some in the room today might be experiencing the consequences of a tight labour market. We've already had some references to the strong construction and infrastructure building activity that's happening in WA, and there's a long pipeline of it. Also in other states around the country. And this means that it can be hard for companies to hire the trades and other construction professionals that they need to get work done. Now, conditions are different in other sectors and parts of the country, but the overall picture of persistent tightness is important because, like that entwined double helix, it is consistent with there still being some inflationary pressure in the economy. Now, given the centrality of the labour market to the economy and to our dual mandate, understanding where full employment is and how far away we currently are is critical. Problem is, pinning it down to something concrete is pretty tricky. It's what we need to do to get a good read on labour market conditions, but it requires considerable effort. We have to draw on a broad set of information, including price and wages indicators, models, and an array of labour market data. And I want to start with those labour market indicators, as this is where our recent thinking has evolved the most. Changes in the labour market can happen in many ways, and these adjustments are not always fully captured by one measure, such as the unemployment rate. For example, the hours someone wants to work can change over time. Parents may want to work part-time when their children are young. Students typically move into full-time work when they graduate. People might dial down their hours as they approach retirement, and so on. And if more people wish to switch jobs, that may encourage businesses to increase wages to retain staff. All of these things can be happening and the unemployment rate not necessarily changing. Evidence from a broad range of labour market indicators has long been a core part of informing monetary policy decisions, but our approach has evolved substantially over recent years as part of our response to the RBA review. Now, the most recent changes that we've made build upon previous work and are outlined in the latest Statement of Monetary Policy. Actually, it's a technical paper that's attached to it for those that want to dig it out. They refine our approach to be more systematic, comprehensive, and transparent, and we will continue improving this over time. Now, there are limitations to any approach, and expert judgment is needed in the selection and interpretation of indicators. To help reduce these limitations, we've refined our choice of indicators that you can see on the screen to ensure that they all contain useful information about future inflation and wages growth. And that's important given the definition of full employment is, as I've said, inextricably tied to what's happening with inflation in the economy. We've also upgraded our benchmarks for judging if a given indicator is tight or loose. Previously, we used a historical average or a range. And while that was a reasonable starting point, it doesn't work well when an indicator is trending up or down over time. So for example, the proportion of adults with a job or looking for a job has steadily trended up over the last few decades. So assessing the current rate against a straight average from the last 30-something years would be misleading. Our new approach tries to account for these underlying trends in each indicator. We use four different statistical detrending methods, and we provide a range for where we think each indicator might be at balance. So, to give us a bird's eye view of what's going on, we pull all of the indicators and our assessment of whether they're signalling a loose or tight labour market together into a single chart, the one you're looking at right now. The vertical line in the middle, it's marked as a zero, shows where we think each indicator would be in a balanced labour market. The blue range that you see for each indicator shows how far that indicator currently is from balance using the four benchmark methods, and it's a range because we're using four methods. And the blue dot that will sit inside the range shows the average of these benchmarks. Therefore, when the blue bar for an indicator is to the right of the chart, it suggests a tight labour market. If it's to the left, it suggests a loose labour market. Currently, most indicators, as you can see, are pointing to a labour market that's at least a little bit tight. But some series, such as job ads and the job finding rate, are suggesting a labour market that is closer to balance or even a little loose. So it's always a range. It's never a clean read. With so many different margins of adjustment, it can be difficult to summarise how labour market conditions are evolving into a single measure. But we do attempt to do that on this next chart. The bottom panel shows the normalised range of indicators that appeared on that earlier chart and how they've changed over time. So overall, the dark green swathe, which is capturing the middle 50% of the indicators I previously showed you, suggests that most indicators have moved closer to balance over recent years, before stabilising in recent months, still a little bit tight. The chart also highlights that these indicators don't always move together. And when that happens, if they're moving apart, the range will widen. If they're moving more together, the range will narrow over time. Now, I've also included in here, as a point of comparison, the top panel shows our pre-existing estimates of labour market tightness and looseness, which use the unemployment rate as a single indicator for labour market conditions. Now, all of these estimates have also gradually moved closer to balance over recent years, but as you can see, there's been less pronounced easing in that single summary indicator that keys off the unemployment rate than in the broader swathe represented on the bottom panel. In other words, some of the adjusting in recent years has come through factors like a fall in the vacancy rate, fewer workers looking to change jobs, a slowdown in hiring by firms, rather than by a rise in the unemployment rate. So one of the most responsive and rapid forms of adjustment in the labour market in the post-COVID years came via job vacancies, the top panel on the chart you're looking at. When starting from a strong job market, the number of vacancies tends to fall quite quickly as demand for labour eases. This is because openings become easier to fill, and some vacancies may just be cancelled as hiring plans are put on ice. As the labour market moves closer to balance, this channel of adjustment tends to slow, as we've seen in Australia over the last 18 months or so. Another important margin of adjustment is changes in the number of hours worked, on average, the middle panel. As the labour market eases, firms will typically reduce the number of hours worked by their employees on average, and this was particularly apparent through 2023. Indeed, it's quite common to see the total number of hours worked in an economy fluctuate much more than the number of people in jobs as economic conditions ebb and flow. And in fact, in the current episode, the number of people in jobs has continued to grow, albeit at a slowing pace, while average hours worked has fallen and remains below its pre-pandemic level. So, taken together then, declining vacancies, slowing growth in the number of people in jobs, and relatively low average hours worked confirm that the rise in the unemployment rate has coincided with it becoming a little harder on average for those looking for a job to find one, rather than a series of redundancies and other people being laid off from work. And finally, one more indicator to flag. From a firm's perspective, what we've seen over the last few years is that it's become much less difficult to find the workers that you need, and that's the bottom panel on this chart. However, the share of firms reporting labour availability as a constraint still remains well above average. And we regularly hear that in our liaison programmes, that firms in some sectors and states still can't find the staff they need to meet. And I've met with a few organisations just in the last couple of days here in Perth, and that's certainly been the message we've heard from those meetings. The easing I've just been describing can be seen as the move in the blue and green swathes back towards zero through 2022 into the early half of last year. The most recent data, though, suggests that conditions in the labour market have stabilised. In the chart, the swathes have flattened off. Now, looking through the usual volatility in the monthly data, what we can see is the unemployment rate and average hours, they've been flat for some time. Some indicators, such as the job finding rate, have continued to ease, but some have actually tightened a little bit. The hiring rate has increased, for example, and at the margin, more firms are reporting labour constraints. So overall, our judgment is that the labour market remains a little bit tight on average. In other words, it's still a bit too difficult for firms to find the workers they need to meet demand in their businesses. It's now worth exploring how we think full employment is entwined with the other half of our mandate, inflation. What does having a labour market that's still a bit tight mean for inflation? And do recent inflation outcomes tell us something or anything about the labour market? As I've outlined, developments in the labour market tell us a lot about how close we are to full employment, and this reflects conditions in the economy more broadly. But let's explore a bit how the relationship between full employment and inflation is entwined. To help answer this question, we use economic models to put a framework around the relationship. Now, inherently, models simplify reality. We do this to make the models tractable, but we know we're not capturing all of the nuance. And this is why we don't rely on models alone. A key framework that links inflation and the labour market is the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, or the NERU. That is a real mouthful. I know. Not the best at naming things, economists, apparently. The NERU is a complex idea with a somewhat unhelpful name, so I'd like to unpack it a little bit. The RBA, like other central banks, has long used NERU models to assess labour market tightness. And like all models, our NERU assessment is subject to considerable uncertainty and judgment, which means we can't be definitive about its level at any given point in time. The way the NERU is modelled and interpreted has also evolved over time, and some colleagues of mine have recently published a paper outlining the evolution of our thinking. So the NERU models were developed in the 1970s, at a time when people's inflation expectations were unanchored, and quite responsive to recent inflation outcomes. What that means is that a temporary increase could lead in inflation, could lead people to change their views to expect higher inflation going forward, even several years into the future. And that was the experience of the 1970s, you can see on the chart. Now, according to the Nehru framework from then, if demand in the economy outstrips supply and the unemployment rate is consistently below the Nehru, then inflation expectations could rise to a level that's not consistent with low and stable inflation. And you could create feedback loops between inflation outcomes and expectations, resulting in continually rising or accelerating inflation. That's where the name comes from. Now, conditions today are quite different. The RBA is now mandated, and has been for some time, to target a specific inflation rate. And expectations for inflation in the future are anchored, in our case, to around 2.5%. And hopefully this chart shows you that. The pink line has not moved in quite some time. In line with this, our interpretation of the Nehru has evolved. And we think of our Nehru models now as estimating the unemployment rate at which current inflation would converge to that expected inflation rate, converge to target. This means that when the labour market is sustainably at full employment, inflation is expected to move from its current rate towards 2.5% and then stay there if the labour market stays at full employment. This also means that when the labour market is tighter or looser than full employment on an ongoing basis, underlying inflation will hold above or below target, but not necessarily accelerate away from it. In other words, we have an anchor, because the feedback loop has been substantially dampened and the old inflation accelerating, decelerating knife edge doesn't fit with today's economy. The non-accelerating part of the Nehru name is a bit out of date. I'd love a suggestion for another name if anyone wants to come up with one. Now, why is all of this important, this evolved understanding? Well, it's pretty important in explaining what has played out in the last few years and how we interpret our data going forward. So, during the post-COVID pandemic inflation surge, we had one of the tightest labour markets we've seen in 50 years. Inflation did rise, but we didn't create a strong feedback loop with expectations. Longer term expectations remain anchored to the RBA's target. And that meant, from a policy perspective, we didn't need to push back against an unhelpful feedback loop between actual inflation turning into higher expectations, turning into higher actual inflation. That wasn't the problem that we had. This made the disinflation seen in 2022 to 25 easier than it otherwise would have been. And our evolved understanding also changes how we read and interpret inflation data to gauge full employment, so what we actually read today. When the labour market is tight and operating beyond full employment, we expect to see inflationary pressures across the economy and an elevated rate of inflation. But crucially, the rate of inflation doesn't have to be continually increasing or accelerating. It can just be holding at a higher level than target. Now, earlier on, I outlined that our models and analysis of just the labour market data indicate that it's still a bit tight. Given what I've just said about the intertwined nature of labour market outcomes and inflation outcomes, what are we reading from current inflation and labour cost data? What are they telling us about the labour market? Well, underlying inflation has picked up recently. It's currently around 3.25%, depends on the measure that you look at. This increase was seen in the quarterly trim mean, which is our preferred measure of underlying inflation, but also for measures that are based on the monthly data as well. The increase in consumer price inflation in the second half of 2025 also brought it more into line with other measures of inflationary pressures that we track through the economy. Output prices, that's the middle chart on this panel, as distinct from prices that are only faced by consumers, that's what's captured in the CPI, but a broader measure of prices, have been increasing by around about 4%, just a touch under a year, for the past couple of years. This suggests businesses along supply chains are increasing prices by a bit more than the CPI, where it has been recently. And it may be that these costs are now being passed on to consumers. Similarly, unit labour costs, the top panel, or the labour cost of producing a unit of output, they've been growing by around 5% for several years now, and different metrics have touched below, but somewhere between 4.5 and 5. And before the pandemic, ULCs were growing at about the same rate as consumer prices, or 2.5% on average, so they're also a bit elevated. Now, we do think that much of the recent rise in inflation likely reflects temporary factors, and these are expected to fade. Some of these include the unwinding of discounting by residential builders and some of the durable goods movements. But the data does also indicate, we think, continued capacity pressure in the economy. Circling back to the labour market, these observations then are consistent with and further reinforce the assessment that conditions are still a bit tight. Like that DNA double helix, a labour market that has been a bit tight for a period of time is linked to and entwined with above target inflationary pressures in the economy. In conclusion, our assessment of full employment, or the maximum level of employment the economy can sustain with low and stable inflation, draws on a broad set of indicators, models, and price dynamics. While the unemployment rate is a very important variable to monitor when assessing how tight or loose the labour market is, it doesn't tell the full story. Labour market conditions evolve in a number of dimensions, including changes in vacancies and average hours worked, and monitoring a range of indicators provides useful information about how easy it is for workers to find jobs and businesses to find workers. Dynamics in the economy have evolved somewhat in recent months, and our full employment framework and Nehru framework indicate that the labour market has stabilised recently and it remains a little bit tight. Recent outcomes for inflation and other labour costs are still sitting above our inflation target, and although we think much of this reflects temporary factors, some of it reflects elevated inflationary pressures in the economy. So as we've seen, our full employment and inflation objectives are entwined, and the data is currently painting a complementary picture with a bit too much pressure on both sides. The recent acceleration of demand growth beyond our estimate of what the economy can sustain, at a time when the economy is already showing signs of being capacity constrained, means we expect the labour market will remain a bit tight and inflation will remain above target for some time, as outlined in our recent statement. In response to these developments, and to help the economy and the labour market back towards balance, the board chose to increase the cash rate at its recent meeting. Moving forward, we'll be closely assessing capacity pressures in the economy and conditions in the labour market, and this will help us assess the extent to which the recent rise in inflation is temporary, and in turn, inform our advice to the Monetary Policy Board. The outlook for inflation and the labour market is core to the Monetary Policy Board's decisions, given its commitment to adjust policy settings as needed to achieve its mandate of both low and stable inflation and full employment. Thank you. I'm looking forward to your questions.
And we'll move on to questions from the audience, so please get your questions ready to go. Sarah, you did touch on this in your speech, but I just wanted to delve into it in a bit more detail. We often, economists and commentators, talk about the trade-off between inflation and unemployment, as if it's from one or the other. You got a dual mandate at the RBA, and you're wanting to achieve that full employment as well as that low and steady inflation within the range. How do you view that in terms of trade-off, around timing, and how does that affect the decision-making of the
bank? Yeah, it's a really good question. So I think framing this or answering this in the current context, really what the board are trying to do with policy, because it really comes back to the policy decision that gets made ultimately. I think that the board have been pretty clear, I hope, on their strategy for some time. And it's really a strategy that's based on how quickly does the economy return to low and stable inflation and return to full employment. So throughout the tightening cycle post-COVID and in the year, the months, years since then, the board have been clear that they want to return inflation to target. They're absolutely committed to doing that. That is important. Low and unstable inflation is the best setting we can have in the economy in terms of inflation. But they wanted to do that in a way that protects the gains in the labour market, is typically how it's been described. And what that means is they want to do it in a way that perhaps it takes a little bit longer for inflation to come back to target, but you get the softening of the labour market is more gradual. The comparison point for this, you can look at other central banks that have returned inflation to target a bit quicker than that. They have to go higher with their interest rates than we have. New Zealand is a good example. They went higher with their interest rates. Inflation has come back down more quickly there, but their labour market has softened much more than ours. So they currently have a much higher unemployment rate, and it lifted a lot more than we did. And so that's really the trade-off. It's more of a temporal trade-off. There isn't actually a trade-off between, in the long run, having a different inflation rate and a different unemployment rate or different labour market conditions. In the long run, that trade-off doesn't exist. It's really the time that you take to return to target. And the board have been clear that they were comfortable with taking perhaps a little bit more time because they did want to have the softening in the labour market happen more slowly. And that is still the strategy. They're still pretty clear on that, I think, and the governor often comments that in public.
That's it. I'm sure we've got some questions from the audience. Just a reminder, if you could state your name and what organisation you're from. And we do have a couple of roving mics. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Sarah, I have a friend who shares your name. It's nice to hear you speak. Thank you very much. You mentioned the phrase which we've heard from the governor of the RBA, capacity pressure, a couple of times. And obviously there's always talk about the link to productivity as a way to unlock some of that pressure. When you look across the economy, what gives you concern in terms of its ability to be more productive, and what gives you hope? Where do you see good progress?
Great. Thanks for the question. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your organisation.
Oh, sorry, I'm Naomi Flutter and I work at Wesfarmers.
Great, thank you. Productivity, I may just talk briefly to the history and what we've seen, since this is what's in the data. It is definitely the case that productivity growth in the economy has slowed down, and that's a long-term prospect. That's over the last sort of 10 years, and certainly the last few years, there's been some particular challenges. I mean, some of it's probably temporary, but some of it probably is structural and looking over that long horizon. I think we have a technical assumption that we make that sort of covers our forecast horizon, which is just 2 years. That's not very long in productivity terms. And the reason it matters for us is that if we're thinking about, really, when we talk about the balance of demand and supply, we're really actually focused on the speed of growth of demand versus the speed of growth of supply. So we have a growing population, for example. More people means, you know, there's more food that needs to be grown and consumed, more houses are needed, more electricity consumed, and so on and so on. So we're talking growth, really. And what we're concerned then is, how quickly is demand growing relative to the sort of growth rate of supply? And slower productivity growth means a slower growth rate for supply. So we can see that that productivity growth has slowed down. In terms of solutions to this, there are many and they are varied. We're definitely not the experts. The governor will often talk about the Productivity Commission and the work that they do. And I know it's also a focus for federal and state governments as well. They've been very vocal about this. I suppose a couple of comments. One, we're a small economy. That means that we're unlikely to be productivity leaders in every single sector. There's just not that many of us compared to the US and other big countries. So it is going to be quite important for us to be able to bring in new technologies that are developed elsewhere, and AI is perhaps a good example of that. So making sure that we can do that and being ready to do that, I think, is important. And I think also, you know, just looking at things like dynamism through the economy, and many authors have worked on this topic, how those new technologies diffuse and flow through, and how easy it is for new firms with new ideas to start up and things like that can also be quite important. But generally speaking, I would point people to the experts on this, and those guys at the Productivity Commission and others in federal and state governments have got lots of good ideas. And productivity matters for us, but it's also fundamentally how we lift living standards. So it does matter for the country overall.
Bits of the economy that worry you, though? You didn't talk about
it. Oh, so, I mean, it's tricky to talk about parts of the economy that might be concerning because, there's very good reasons for us to have the industrial and the structure that we do. So I tend to think about it much more in those sort of more aggregate sense. And I also tend to think about it in the context of, well, where does productivity growth come from? And what do we need to float through the economy? So I think a lot of what I just said probably applies to pretty much every sector. All sectors sort of have to at least try and lift to get that aggregate to come up.
Thanks, Matt McKenzie from the West Australian. Tradie shortage, does that reflect excess demand or some other factor? And secondly, historically inflation seems to bounce back very quickly, looking at history from the 70s and the 80s and so on. So was it perhaps over-enthusiastic to cut rates 3 times last year?
So on your first question, certainly we can see very clearly that there is a very strong demand if we're talking tradies, I tend to think of construction, people work in the construction sector. It's very strong demand in all aspects of the construction sector right now, residential, non-residential buildings, so data centres form a big part of that at the moment, because they're building a lot of those, and then infrastructure, and I'm sure many people here will be very familiar with the infrastructure projects happening on the ground in WA. There's strong demand. There's not the supply of the skilled workforce that can meet that demand. And we hear that very, very regularly through our liaison program. It's also reported in the business surveys. Many people in the room, I'm sure, have got an anecdote or two about it being tough to find someone to come and do some work. On your second question, it's really the forecasting is a really difficult business, and our forecasts are often wrong. In fact, in the S&P, we publish the average size of our historical errors as our fan chart. So, if you look at our forecast charts in the S&P, they're not just straight lines on a chart. There's actually a fan around them, and the fan captures the errors. So, look, things change, events happen that we don't predict and foresee. In terms of what we thought was happening in the economy last year and what's changed from then to now, I think there's a few factors I'd highlight. First, global conditions really did change quite rapidly and turned out to be, the global economy turned out to be a lot more resilient than we were anticipating. So tariffs and other US policy settings, clearly still a lot of flux and uncertainty around that. But in the global trading system adjusted much more quickly and proved to be much more resilient than many people were expecting. Also the AI boom globally, the investment boom globally, has been very, very strong, much stronger than was anticipated. And I think importantly for Australia, this has shown up in two ways. One, in actual investment in data centres and on the ground here in Australia that we weren't anticipating perhaps at the start of last year. But also too, in terms of global activity. So it's been, obviously we've got a lot of activity happening in the US, but that's spilled back through into the Asian supply chains. So Taiwan, Korea, Singapore, these sort of high tech, high value add manufacturing countries are growing very, very strongly. And they are a key export market for us, certainly when you put them together. So there's been some strength there. We've also seen, perhaps with financial conditions, that they haven't been as restrictive as we thought they would be. So we've seen a number of aspects of that. Risk premiums are very low at the moment. Equity markets are, wiggles day to day aside, are at pretty high levels. Credit growth has been pretty strong. So that's all flying into the economy. And we've had domestic demand, private demand has recovered more quickly than we are anticipating. We did expect there to be a recovery in the private sector through the back half of last year. It's just been a bit stronger than we were anticipating. That's both household spending and investment. I mentioned business investment also on the dwelling investment side too. So a whole lot of things have come through more positively than we were expecting. Obviously inflation has come through more strongly than we were anticipating, and so our advice to the board has taken that in and has, and the board have decided now was the right time that they needed to to raise rates, and that's obviously is what it is. So a lot of things have shifted and moved, and that's really what's changed the assessment of the economy, and then the board have responded with their decision for the cash rate.
Thanks very much. I'm James Campbell, from the City of Manchester, WA's largest region of the city. I'm just really interested in one of your charts you had there, Sarah, where, the one on that had the output prices, and that shot up around about 4%, and it made me wonder, do you have specific rules of thumb for each of the transmission mechanisms, the way it goes in? So I imagine if there's an exchange rate shock, probably happens pretty fast, feeds into CPI or what have you, whereas others are pretty wages might be a bit slower. I'd be interested to know what sort of time frame do you think about while you're modelling that stuff?
Yeah, it's a good question. So normally we think about sort of lags and how things flow through the economy from a sort of monetary policy perspective. So, you know, the cash rate changes, for instance. How long does that take to show up in the economy? What we find in our models is there are a number of different transmission channels for monetary policy, and they work at different time horizons. So one of the quickest ones is one that you mentioned, actually, the exchange rate. And in fact, the exchange rate, the Aussie dollar, has strengthened a bit recently against the US dollar, but actually against a broad basket of goods. And I've got some of the mining sector in the room probably very aware of that, given your revenue tends to be earned in foreign currency. And so that one can happen very, very quickly. In fact, we think that some of the lift in the exchange rate just recently reflects the fact that markets have changed their expectations for the cash rate. And so that will start coming into the economy straight away. It does take time for it to pass through fully into consumer prices. It also takes a bit of time for it to pass through fully into actual activity. So for example, one of the channels, if the exchange rate stays stronger now than it was over the past year, I'd expect to see through this year that we might get a pickup in the number of people choosing to take their holiday overseas rather than staying at home, because it's a bit cheaper now to go overseas than it otherwise would have been a year ago. And at the margin, some people might decide Bali's the place for a holiday this year as opposed to the Gold Coast. But we'll wait and see. It's got to, you know, you have to see that exchange rate move sustained for those kind of decisions to be made. But I use it as an example of transmission, it taking a bit of time. Other channels that are quite quick, everyone I'm sure will know this one, the cash flow channel, which is what we call the mortgage interest rate channel. Most people with a mortgage, vast majority, have a variable rate mortgage. That will happen very quickly, and you'll start seeing that in if you're on your repayments pretty soon. The channel, though, is actually, it's relatively small in an aggregate sense. I want to stress that. If you have a mortgage, if you have a very large mortgage, it's clearly very important to you individually. That's absolutely true. But only around a third, actually a touch less, of people have a mortgage on their own, in the home that they own. Everyone else either owns their own home outright or they're renters, in which case they're not impacted by this cash flow channel. So that's why it's small in an aggregate sense, but it can be very large for an individual. That's quite a quick one. But others, finally, that take a little bit longer are decisions that households and businesses might make over whether or not to save a bit more money today versus spending it today. So as a household, if you get a higher rate of interest, you've got some money deposited at the bank, maybe you choose to save a bit more because you're earning a bit more interest. As a business, you might be looking at a slightly higher cost of borrowing because the cash rate's gone up, and that might make you put a project on ice if it was a bit marginal. But that project may not have been kicking off for 6, 12, 18 months, or you make the decision today not to do it, so there's a long lag there. And same thing for building your own home, dwelling, construction activity. Again, if you're borrowing to fund that and just at the margin the project doesn't quite work and you decide not to do it, then that activity won't happen, but it would have happened, not today necessarily, but in the future. So yeah, there's a lot of lags and pass-through from those sort of cost side into final inflation from policy all the way through into inflation can take quite some time. So we typically think that when we aggregate it up, peak impact from a policy rate change is sort of 9 to 12 months after the change, but it ebbs all the way through to maybe 18 to 24 months. So some impact today, it builds, and then it ebbs away.
Thank you.
Just a follow-up, actually.
Virginia Christie, Economic Regulation Authority. Just to follow up to that question and the lags in monetary policy and the impact on the labour market. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the economy changes all the time, the lags will change as well. Can you give us a rough estimate, Sarah, of a decision by the board today, how long it would take affect labour market decisions?
It's about that sort of lag structure I just talked about. Inflation is typically the last sort of thing that it shows up in, labour market a bit sooner, activity a bit before that, but it's around that time horizon, which is actually why we have to do forecasting. Thank you, Cass, for saying what you did. Forecasting is really tricky. I've been doing it a long time. I've got a good sort of list of things I've gotten wrong, and where I've always tried to learn to, you know, understand what did I miss. But this is why we have to do forecasting, because when the cash rate decision, whatever it is, isn't really having much of an impact today, it's having an impact in the future. And that's why we need to understand what we think the future is going to look like, and then you adjust policy accordingly. So it's a difficult business, but it's a necessary business precisely because of these lags.
Just do a quick follow-up. The other one was around migration, actually, and the impact of migration, because migration is a big thing for West Australian businesses especially, and the impact on labour market dynamics.
Yeah, so migration is, Australia has a long history with migration. Obviously, migrants have been moving here for decades and decades and decades. And that's still, certainly still the case, and that migration, overseas migration is still positive. In terms of how we think about it impacting the economy, we tend to think in the long run on a per capita basis and in terms of inflation, it's broadly neutral. So when people move here, they might be moved, especially if they come here as a skilled worker. They come here and they'll supply themselves to the labour market, so they'll be on the supply side of the labour market. But because they live here, they need to eat, they need somewhere to live. They'll go out and eat in restaurants and need clothes and all those other goods and services. So they contribute to demand as well. And in the long run, the evidence that we have suggests that it's broadly neutral. So there's some supply, they come in, they provide some supply, they add to demand, and these two sort of cancel each other off. And so you don't get any impact on inflation in particular. Both the supply and demand are bigger, the economy is larger, but inflation is a broadly neutral effect. In the short run, that's not necessarily true, because the supply of some of the goods and services that households need is fixed. That can be particularly true in local housing markets. And we saw that a little bit, the impact of that through the COVID migration recovery, where some parts of the rental market, more in Sydney and Melbourne than here, Western Australia had strong population growth because of internal migration as well as overseas migration. But in some parts of Sydney and Melbourne, it was pretty clear that rents were rising, partly because there was this new demand that had suddenly come back as people could return to the economy. So there can be some short-run dynamics as well, and we've written about that in the past. But in the long run, we tend to think, from a monetary policy perspective, it's neutral. But obviously, there's much broader questions with migration, which I'd leave to others in other policy arms to tackle.
Thanks. Sally McMahon, Australian Energy Market Commission.
Thanks, it's been great to listen to you today. This might be a bit obvious, but I'm really keen to hear directly from you your views on full employment. And it's often talked about as potentially another target that we're trying to achieve in the Australian economy, but over time, both the way we measure it and the way we talk about it in economics is changing. And I was just really keen to hear from you, you know, how important is it that we move away from that language, or should we still embrace it but measure it and talk about it differently?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And you're right, there is definitely a time dimension to this. I might sort of draw on some of what I said in the speech. So in the short term, so over a sort of 1-2 year horizon, which is the horizon monetary policy is really focused on, structural shifts in the labour market, they're innately quite slow moving. And so they won't typically have too much of an impact over that sort of short run horizon. That might not be completely true, and actually I just made a reference to the recovery in migration post-COVID. We'd not seen anything like that before, but clearly quite exceptional circumstances, setting those types of periods aside. the labour market structurally doesn't change that quickly over a 1-2 year horizon. So that horizon, from the perspective of us giving monetary policy advice, I think the definition we have works quite well. What is the capacity of the labour market, the capacity of the economy, and that if the economy is operating at that capacity, then we should have inflation low and stable, because it should be lining up with our target 2.5% low and stable. Over time, though, clearly that capacity can change and structural shifts happen. I talked very briefly about what economists call the participation rate, which is the proportion of people who are either in work or looking for work of the total population. That has changed dramatically over decades long horizon. We have many more women that now participate in the labour force than before. I think that's actually fantastic that women are able to do that, and society is now facilitating that much more. The people might be now working a bit longer, so retiring a little bit later as life expectancies have lifted. More people going off to university and delaying their entry to the workforce, that's also been playing out as well. And many other changes besides, so more people proportionally now are choosing to work part-time than have in the past, and so that has implications for total labour supply as well. Those kind of structural changes playing through, they really, really matter on a longer term basis, and it is for society, I suppose, to decide what it thinks is appropriate in terms of policy settings to enable that or otherwise. And looking at it on that time horizon, you really do need to think about how you measure full employment. It has to be more than just what is the unemployment rate. And there's, how do we even think about holistically what people want to participate in the labour market, to what extent, and how do we capture those kind of metrics? We do try with some of our data, but it is a bit incomplete. But I agree, actually, you need to think about it very holistically. I don't think over a long time period it makes sense to just narrow down on one or two metrics, because I think you are missing a lot of the big picture.
And it doesn't make sense to keep a target in a sense, or?
So I think that this is where, in the context of monetary policy, why we don't put a number on it, because it's very hard to, and I'm not sure we could ever actually measure it, because we would really have to understand how every single person wants to interact with the labour market, and I'm not sure we'll ever get to having that type of information. So I think it's more the dual mandate. I think it's there as a sort of a framing for how the board makes its decisions, but the reality, if I compare how the board here makes decisions compared to other central banks that might only have a formal inflation mandate, I'm not sure that the decision making is that different. And I think in whatever the case, the boards in those countries, or the equivalent to the boards in those countries, are always pretty clear on their strategy, and that's actually what really matters in the context of setting policy.
Paula Gadsby, EY. Thanks for the presentation, Sarah. I just had a question on the RBA. Do you think you're putting a bit too much weight on the temporary factors driving the recent pickup in inflation? For example, housing inflation is running at 5.5%. Market services is running over 4% as well. They tend to be more persistent and sticky. And a lot of the supply constraints in these areas will likely take a while to abate.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's certainly it's a key judgment in the forecasts. This will sound a bit like a get out of jail free card, but we will find out as the data plays out. I'm always thinking about the risks around the forecast, how things might play out differently, how would that manifest in the economy, what would that mean for the advice that I and the team are giving the board. It's certainly something we're watching, those two sectors in particular, because you're absolutely right, they are typically more persistent in terms of inflation than some of the other sectors, and they do give a really very clear read on domestic capacity constraints, which is the thing we can tackle. We can't do anything really about international conditions. They are what they are, so I worry less about, say, oil price movements than I do about the sectors you've highlighted. It's certainly on our minds, and I mean we're careful with our language. We do think that some of what we've seen is a sign of those more persistent pressures. That is reflected in the new forecast profile, where inflation is higher than we thought in November. It's higher again than we thought back in August. And that does reflect exactly what you're talking about. And but we'll find out. I hope that inflation does track back down. It would be great if it tracked back down a bit sooner. That would be a very good outcome. But we'll find out.
Hi, Peter Halloran. I'm an energy and economic diversification. Sarah, I was curious as to whether the RBA has seen any evidence around how much housing availability is affecting labour mobility, and by extension, labour costs, if businesses are having to offer higher premiums for people of them.
Yeah, it's a really good question. So it is something that sometimes comes up in some of our liaison conversations. So for those that don't know, we run a liaison program where we interview, or we hold about 900 interviews a year with organizations right across the country, across all sectors, not just businesses, but we talk to not-for-profits, other community organizations, industry bodies, government institutions, so a real broad gambit. And we do hear from some of our contacts there, particularly in more regional and rural areas, that the sheer supply of housing is a challenge for getting labour into their business. So, I'm in a rural area, there aren't actually enough homes here to house people, and I can't expect someone to move to take a job with me if there's nowhere for them to live. And so we do hear that that's a challenge. We hear about people coming up with somewhat creative solutions to that as well. It's clearly a real issue that for some businesses is definitely a constraint on them getting the people that they need. The extent of how widespread it is really the question that we ask ourselves from a monetary policy perspective, and obviously particularly in the larger cities, it's not so extreme in that way. Housing is expensive, rents are high and rising, but there are homes available, actual physical homes available. We do hear that, and it does sort of come through in terms of those total labour costs that we track.
I'll throw one to you then. Sarah, you spent most of the week over here in wonderful Western Australia. How are you seeing conditions on the ground here, and how is the RBA viewing the economy here in Western Australia, and how is it different to the rest of the nation?
Yeah, thanks, Kaz. It's been a lovely week. The weather's been fantastic, I have to say. It really turned it on for me, just perfect. It's been great being over here. So I flew in on Monday, and I'm heading out tomorrow. It's been interesting sort of looking at the numbers from afar and then coming here and hearing it on the ground. Generally speaking, from afar, it looked as though the economy here was, if anything, a bit tighter than the national average. So the unemployment rate's a little bit lower. I mean, that's usually true for WA, but it looks like it's a bit more true now than historically average. And we can see in terms of demand growth that the economy's growing a bit more strongly than the national average as well. And the population growth might be a bit of a part of that, but generally speaking, it looked as though conditions here were stronger than in some of the other states. Having come here and had a few meetings and talking to lots of people, that definitely seems to be the actual lived experience. We were talking earlier on about the shortage of tradies. I've heard that from quite a few different organisations on the ground working in various different sectors. I've also heard a lot about the amount of work, the number of big projects that are in the pipeline across a number of different sectors, and questions about how do we get it all done over the next few years. So it does feel like an economy that, if anything, is a bit tighter than the national average. That looked like in the numbers, and that seems to be what I'm hearing on the ground. The only final thing I'd say is that it's not uncommon for that to be true. It's actually really, really common for some parts of the country to be going a bit stronger than other parts. If someone's strong, someone has to be, in a relative sense, a bit softer. We're setting policy for the aggregate, but it is interesting to see where are the pockets of particular pressure, and WA does seem to be one of those at the moment.
Hi Sarah, Rico Stevens, University of Notre Dame, Australia. Also, we're the Economic Society of Australia hacked as well. We heard last year from the governor in the Shan lecture about how the bank itself is using artificial intelligence. Mm. I wonder if you might speak to your thinking on the structural trends and things in AI and how the bank is taking account of that in the labour market, particularly on the demand side modelling.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's obviously still as a technology evolving incredibly rapidly. You know, like 2 or 3 years ago, probably most of us haven't heard of ChatGPT, and now it's everywhere. But it's still, I think, pretty early days for seeing what it means for the labour market. I think in the Shan lecture, the governor talked about how what's likely to happen with a technology like AI, which is a generalist technology, and what economists mean by that is that the same technology can be used in a lot of different sectors right across the economy, as opposed to a specialist technology that might only have uses in one particular sector, like a particular piece of equipment or machinery that's relevant for construction. You wouldn't probably catch me using that in the office as I do my work. So generalist technologies, typically what you'll see is they do take some time to diffuse through the economy. This time could be quicker, but you're still probably talking years, not months. And you know, thinking back to say the personal computer revolution, they first sort of started to appear in the early 1980s, but it did take a solid 10 plus years actually for most people to be using one in their work, and even longer than that to really mobilize the gain. So even if it's quicker than that, even half the time, we're still talking quite a few years. So I think we're not seeing the impact yet in the labor market. And in terms of what it's likely to do, I think that it will change the nature of the jobs that we have. Some of the tasks that we currently do, I think the AI will do them for us. I think and certainly hope that at least some of those tasks are the kind of boring stuff that's a bit repetitive, a bit too manual, and you know, AI, if AI is doing that rather than me or whoever else, then that's generally a good thing. I think back to when I started my career, which is you know, a fair few years ago now, one of the first things I had to do was construct a national account set for a country that I was working on as part of a project. You'd never have to do that these days because the information is electronic. And when I say construct, I mean type it in from paper sheets by hand. You wouldn't have to do that now. The technology would do so much of that manual work for you. It would save you bags of time. And that's great. That's productivity growth right there. I think we're probably in that world in terms of it changing people's jobs. Some of what we do is going to go away and disappear because the technology will do it for us, and that's great. But it'll open up opportunities as well. And I think what can be tricky when you're living it in real time is to figure out what the new jobs are. I think they will be created, they will exist. I don't know what they are though. And I think it's what's going to be really important for you know, for individuals and for the country as a whole is to try and figure that out so that we can make sure that we're all equipped to pivot and move and evolve and make best use of the technology, know its strengths, know its limitations. If we can do that, then we will really harness the productivity gains. But there's a transition to be had, and I don't want to be too sort of rosy about it. The transition will mean you know some roles might, you know, at least the number of people doing that job might grow more slowly because we don't need as many people doing those types of roles. But I think other opportunities will open up. And so the aggregate, it'll just be a change in the makeup of the labour force.
Bit of a follow-up to that, if there are concerns about those entry-level roles and those skill development that we get and, you know, those graduate roles or when you're there constructing your national accounts and, you know, learning a lot during the process, that we don't have that pathway with AI?
I think we've probably just got to figure out ways to make sure that as people enter the workforce and they're building up their skills and experience, that it's the right type of skill and experience building that means that they can carry on in their careers. So if I carry on with my example, I'm not sure that I gained very much in terms of skills by, I was very, very good with the number keypad on my keyboard by the end of that project, so I did an awful lot of number typing. I'm not sure that's a skill I need to perfect and hone. I'm still probably pretty good at it now, but you know, I could probably do my job and not be so good at that. But the understanding that I got from doing it of how an economy is structured and you know how it sits together and how different sectors interact with one another, that is pretty crucial, right, for what I now do. And so it's I think to use that example, you want to keep the good, but you know perhaps there is some of this more manual work that we can, or repetitive work that we can let go of, and that would be a good thing.
You've touched on a little bit about the global economy and that essentially it's surprised on the upside over the last year in particular, and we've seen that strength. How do you view that going forward? Still a fair bit of turmoil globally, politically and economically. Is that something that could change relatively quickly, or you know, how confident are you in that global growth picture?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think you'll see in our latest statement of monetary policy, we spend a fair amount of time talking about the global outlook. I think a couple of things that we're monitoring quite closely. One, even though the what's happened over the last year has generally surprised us to the upside, there are definitely still risks that you've referred to, and so we're definitely still monitoring those. And you know, we do have concerns that policy settings might shift so much that you know that potentially there is a correction in financial markets, or potentially we do start to see some substantial real economy impacts. I think even if we don't get that sort of very, very bad downside case, and we did explore that in our May SMP, if you want to go back and revisit. We're also looking very closely to see what are the impact of the shift in tariff policy settings in particular on global trade flows and trading patterns and how they evolve over time. And so one thing we're mindful of, it might be that there isn't a sharp slowdown, but it could be just a sort of a drag on that those trade flows and those trading patterns and that globalization process over time. And so that manifests much more slowly, you know, year to year to year, but over time if you aggregate it up, it then becomes substantial. So we're certainly looking at things, and we're always monitoring these risks, and they are definitely still there, but it's just been really quite surprising over the last year how resilient the global economy has been.
And here in WA, the Chinese economy is by far our biggest trading partner, and you know, we feel some of those movements pretty significantly here. Do you have particular views on the direction of the Chinese economy and how that's holding up?
Yeah, so China, generally speaking, if you look over the last few years, the pace of growth there has gradually slowed, and obviously look through the COVID disruption as well, but generally speaking, it's gradually slowed. We think that that's likely to continue. We don't know yet what the formal growth target for this calendar year is. That hasn't been announced, but if we look at what the sort of major states and provinces over there are announcing, we think it's going to be, you know, between 4.5 and 5. Our forecast for this year is 4.6% growth, so you know, it's something in that ballpark, and we'll see what we get. So it's that continuation of that moderation in the pace of growth. There are definitely risks in the Chinese economy. You know, we can see that rates of inflation are very low over there. The private sector, in particular households, are still quite soft in their momentum relative to history, and you know, savings rate there is a bit elevated. So those sorts of signs of weaker demand are certainly there. But equally, the economy has been able to find some new export markets for its products, new products and new markets put together. So, you know, we can see it on the ground in Australia. You know, Chinese electric vehicles in particular, but cars are now much more sighted on the roads. They've been building that export market for other products as well in the renewable energy space, and even exporting steel, which hasn't been a traditional export product for them, but they are now finding markets for that. So it's certainly a bit of a mixed picture, often described as a two-speed economy. We're monitoring it very closely, but our expectation is that growth would continue that gradual slowdown trend, and we'll wait and see what we get from policymakers. So the US is, in terms of the upside surprise over the last year, the US as a single country has surprised more than anyone else. Growth in the US, it does look pretty robust. It's an interesting mix of it's robust in terms of demand growth, but the labour market perhaps is softening there. And so, you know, how do you sort of marry those two things together? Part of the marrying together actually is productivity. So we talked earlier about slowdown in productivity growth here in Australia. We've seen that in a number of countries around the world, a number of advanced economies, but not really in the US recently. They have been a bit of an exception to the rule. And so they've been able to sort of marry this, not sharp slowing in their labour market, but just softening in their labour market with continued strength and growth. And so how much of that continues, how much of it's due to the AI boom? I think these are key questions for us. But looking ahead, growth probably softens a little bit, but it's not a terrible outlook by any stretch of the imagination. In terms of what that means for Australia, they're a relatively small export market for us. So directly, not a big impact on the economy here, although for particular sectors, they're a large market, they're beef, for example. It's more what that would mean and how it spills back through the global economy. So what does that mean for East Asia in particular? Because that is our large market. That's how we typically track it and think about it.
Just super quickly, related to that one, about US dollar, really. So that's had its history as a world currency, or its expressionless, what have you. And I wondered what your view is, probably a difficult question, whether the recent change you see probably undermines or underpins a lot of their borrowing capacity as well, from those current account deficits as well. Do you think there's a chance, how worried or how much of a risk do you think it is that that role starts to unwind as the sort of world reserve currency and therefore is exhausted, pretty traditional, that sort of stuff?
It's certainly something that we're thinking about and thinking about what it might mean. I think to perhaps put some of the currency movements in perspective, though, and some of the capital flow movements, it is true that there has been some shift in the flow, the destination for some of the capital flows, but there's limited evidence of the stock of investments and capital allocation shifting. And it's also true that some of the currency moves might well reflect some of those shifts in flow pattern, but again, that doesn't necessarily mean the stock is changing. And some of the change, particularly for the Aussie dollar in recent weeks, as I've mentioned earlier, is actually, we think, related to shifts in policy rate expectations and expectations for the economy here. So it's always really tricky with exchange rates and capital movements to unpack it all into nice discrete buckets, and it's rarely just one thing that's pushing these flows around. So yeah, look, it's something that we're certainly looking at and monitoring and thinking about, but in terms of it happening very, very quickly, we don't see evidence of that right now. But yeah, look, we'll keep an eye on it for sure, because as you very well pointed out, it does really matter for the global economy.
We're almost out of time, so I'll see you one question to wrap up, Sarah. As we just had an interest rate decision, and we kind of look forward to the next one. Acknowledging the economists in the room are definitely looking forward to it out of interest, at least. And acknowledging that you look very broadly around the economy when making these decisions, are there particular indicators or sectors that you're really going to be looking at over the next few weeks or months to get that idea about the direction of where things are?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I'll start the answer with, we really will look at everything pretty much, and I won't try and give the whole list of all the different data series and things that we track. But I think that the fundamental question that I'll be pretty focused on is it relates to an answer earlier, just thinking about the domestic economy, that balance between demand, underlying demand in the economy, and our supply capacity, and how that's manifesting in inflation, and how much of the inflation that we've recently seen is temporary. I do think that's an absolutely critical question for us. But that doesn't mean that we won't stop looking at everything else. We will keep looking definitely at international conditions and how they're evolving, and considering that broader picture. But yeah, I think that for the near term, that's clearly near top of mind for us, because we really do need to understand that. And in understanding that, to take us all the way back to the speech, that will help us really understand the labour market and current labour market conditions, and what do we think that, in a broad sense, full employment looks like, because that's what the mandate is. So,
busy time for everyone. Thank you. I'll invite Adam back up to the stage.